Oftentimes, the things that we do with our money that are unhelpful are ways to soothe the anxiety and depression. So I may have anxiety and depression because of trauma that might not have anything to do with money, but my soothing mechanism for my anxiety and depression might be shopping or financial avoidance. And then what happens is that leads to even more anxiety or depression. And then that's how it all becomes linked together.
I'm Kadeem Lehler.
And I'm Bethan Moorcraft.
And this is the Half Bank Podcast.
So Kadeem, have you ever had a bad day or a bad week and you just decided to splurge on something to make yourself feel better?
Absolutely. I think food's usually the culprit for me. Jamaican food specifically, usually, you know, 20, 30 bucks at a time. Figure, you know, I'm treating myself. I've been pretty good with money, so it's worth it. But, you know, 20, 30 bucks can add up pretty quick, especially if you treat yourself pretty often. What about you?
It's funny how you can be the best budgeter or planner, but your mood can still have an impact on your bank account. And it can go the other way too. So your financial situation can have a huge impact on your mental health. A recent survey by FP Canada found that almost half of Canadians from the age of 18 to 34 have experienced some financial stress that has then hurt their mental health.
Well, there's a lot to be stressed out about right now. Life's pretty expensive, especially for young people. We either have high rent, high housing costs, interest rates, paying off student debt, and there might be a recession coming as well.
Definitely. And there's just a lot of pressure to keep up, even when times are tough. A Credit Karma study found that 50% of those aged 18 to 38 have gone into debt in order to keep up with their peers financially, which is quite a scary statistic, but I'm sure all of us have felt that pressure at some point. There's just a lot of shame and anxiety around this, and that's why we're talking to Alyssa Davies about her experience with debt and mental health.
Alyssa Davies is a content manager and published author living in Calgary, Alberta. She's also the founder of finance blog Mixed Up Money, which was named Canadian Personal Finance Blog of the Year. There, she shares her best resources and tips for creating a shame-free look at money. Welcome, Alyssa.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
No problem. Thank you for joining us. So today we want to look at mental health and money. I think much less stigma about the exploration of mental health nowadays compared to, say, 10 years ago, but still more ways to go. I think you probably agree on that.
Yes.
So you have spoken and written a lot about your experiences with debt and getting out of it. So I'm wondering if you can just first start by telling us a little bit about your financial journey.
Sure. So I really, before I started my blog, did not know much about money. I had very little experience when it came to budgeting, personal finance, investing. I was just kind of floating through life, which I don't think is very uncommon for anyone who's in their early 20s. So from 2013 to 2015, I was in a really tough place financially. I was bouncing between working full-time in marketing, and I also went back to school a couple of times, and I just never felt secure. I was struggling to pay my bills, making ends meet, and I felt like I had no control over my money. It was just in on payday and out the next day and using credit to fund my lifestyle the rest of the time.
Thank you. And I believe I can also relate to that. I think I saw Beth nodding as well. So I feel like, especially when you mentioned that early 20s piece, you're just sort of going along with life, probably not much conscious planning at that stage. And I guess I'm wondering at that stage as well, when you're going through and trying to kind of figure things out, what does that do to your mental health at that stage? And then what does kind of getting out of that period of your life do as well?
So what happened is that one of the times I went back to school, my then boyfriend, now husband, proposed to me. And at that moment, it was like excitement and so many new things to look forward to. But it was also an aha moment of how am I supposed to afford a wedding? And I'm still in college. Like, I feel like I don't have a lot of direction in my life right now. And so I actually started looking for jobs again so that I could find more financial security in my life. And ironically, I ended up landing a job at a not-for-profit debt consolidation organization. So I ended up working in marketing for people who were helping others get out of debt. And during the training I had to sit in on, I realized I was the client. And I was like, if I don't change something in my life right now, I'm going to be in one of these sessions and I'm going to be reaching out for help because I won't be able to do it on my own. And so about a week later, I had launched my blog and just started openly sharing my finances on the internet for everyone to see. And dove right in. And it was probably one of the best decisions I made for my mental health, because at that point, I did not know how bad my anxiety and my depression was getting.
It's interesting what you just said about realizing you are the client. I think that everybody, unless they're really lucky, has one of those kind of like moments where they're like, I need to sort of think about this a bit more responsibly, or, you know, take a real deep dive into my finances. And you never know when that's going to happen. But for a lot of us, it is in that kind of early, mid to late 20s where you're starting to think about kind of bigger life goals. So it's definitely interesting that you say that, Alyssa. Another thing that you said is that you never felt secure with your finances when you were younger. How does financial security impact your mental health? And how are you feeling about your money right now?
Well, I know that money is deeply connected to mental health. I had always had anxiety. I don't know if I knew how to label it back when I was younger. I also didn't realize that when you have anxiety, if you don't do much to manage it, it can push you into depression. And because of all of the financial burdens that I faced, that was what was happening. I was being pushed into a depressive state. It got to a point where I felt like I don't have a way out of this. And at the time, I did not realize it was connected to money. But knowing what I know now and knowing how I felt on the day that I did pay off my debt, I had this shift where I suddenly felt like you could literally feel physically this weight being lifted off your shoulders. And it was almost like I was at peace, but I didn't know what to do because it was so heavy and it had been weighing on me for so long. And I think that's what happens for so many people. Like, there's so many studies, you know, like 30 to 40% of Canadians, like money is their biggest concern in their life right now. And that's over work, that's over relationships, that's over their health and like their physical health. And it's not a small thing in our lives because money is connected to everything we do. Everything we do revolves around money, whether it's, you know, your hobbies, whether it's paying for your groceries, your rent. You cannot do much if you don't have control over your money and if you don't have enough money to go around for all of these things you're supposed to pay for once you hit adulthood.
Mm-hmm. It's that classic issue of pushing the problem under the rug, carrying on, and then it just builds and builds. It's an interesting issue, and I'm sure it's something that a lot of people experience, as you said. While financial security can impact mental health, it can also go both ways. What are some ways that mental health impacts financial health?
Oh, there are a lot of ways. I think if you're not in a great place with your mental health, or if you have ADHD, or if you have anxiety, or if you have depression, all of those things actually dictate our money in a very different way. So they can have a large play in our money management. If you have ADHD, there are a lot of symptoms that will come with that that directly impact your finances. If you're forgetful, it's something as small as maybe you don't realize you already bought groceries that you have in your fridge and you go and buy them again, or you forget to pay your bills because you have a lot going on in your mind. Those things happen and they're so unspoken of that a lot of us feel this deep shame and deep guilt for doing things that we don't really have control over because we don't have 100% set on our mental health. Like if we are so busy using all of our mental energy, trying to focus on this one part of our mental health that isn't there or isn't working the way we want it to, then your money just kind of falls in the back. And it's not a bad thing. It's just something that you have to recognize and you have to find a way to work it in with whatever you're dealing with when it comes to mental health. And I wish that more people spoke about those things so that we could actually make it less shameful.
You're just talking about organization, basically, was a piece of that as well. Sometimes maybe forgetting things, and that can be due to mental health or just disorganization. So are there specific tools that you've used as well along your journey?
I think a lot of people require different financial tools to make their money work for them. So for me, because I have a lot of anxiety, things that really helped me with my money were compartmentalizing all of those items that make me feel like I was losing control. Because that's what it all came back to for me, is that I felt like I didn't have that security piece in lock. And so I always make sure that I have my emergency funds set, ready to go. That is my number one thing that I need to feel secure financially. And so I actually have 3 emergency funds. It's a little bit of an overkill. Some people don't like that. But really, it is one big emergency fund split up into 3 categories so that I can spend that money without feeling overwhelmed. So I have an emergency fund that is for my household because I'm a homeowner and there are a lot of big expenses that can come up unexpectedly. I have a fund that is for our family. So if myself or my husband lost our jobs, we would be able to pay for our expenses. And then I also have an account, and my husband has an account that is for relationships. So if something were to happen where one of us passed away unexpectedly, where something happened in our relationship that was outside of our control, we both feel like we have that protection. And so those are the most important tools for me. The second tools that are important for me are smaller accounts that are sinking funds for expenses that are inevitable throughout the year. So that when Christmas comes, I already have my savings for the gifts I plan to buy or for the events I plan to attend. Or when vacations come up, I've already saved enough money so that when I go on that vacation, I'm not putting those funds on credit. They're paid for before we go. Those things can reduce the stress load so much for someone who doesn't feel like they have control over their finances. I think everyone needs to manage their money differently. It's unique in that sense, because if you do have a different sort of mental health issue, like ADHD or like depression, you might need to shift things around. You might need to be more strict with tracking your spend. You may need to budget. You may need to avoid budgeting and only do check-ins once a month. There are different ways you can manage your money. It doesn't have to be all the same. And I think a lot of people think, I have to have a budget. I have to do A, B, C, because that's what the financial experts tell me. But that doesn't have to be the only way to manage your money.
Is that something you've learned along the way in your journey? Or have you had some good advice along the way as well from either a professional advisor or family or friends who've kind of helped you reach this stage?
That's a great question. I feel like when I started talking about money, learning about money, I did everything very traditionally because that's the content I could find. That's what I was reading. And it has shifted so much in the past 7 years because there are more people talking about it. There are more people I can relate to talking about it. There are more resources to learn. And I think I've learned a lot about how unique we all are as people. How important it is to talk about what this system does to people, how this system impacts people and their money, and how that makes us feel about money. And so I've changed a lot, and I've read a lot, and I've looked and asked questions from people that aren't the same as me, because those perspectives really matter.
So I wanted to ask, I know recently you had posted a story on Instagram looking at how Instagram, you know, is a, social media as a whole is a highlight reel. I think you're, you know, treadmill, and it was in your basement and so forth, saying not kind of a fancy studio, not a fancy gym, like just showing the reality of your situation. And I guess obviously with mental health, social media, I feel like it's just sort of intertwined with that in terms of how things are represented and, you know, not necessarily always truthfully shown or shown in full. So I guess I'm wondering, what is the impact if you feel like that's had on you personally, and how do you try to combat that with basically what you post and also how you consume social media?
Social media is so interesting. I find that I consume it less and less the more time I spend as someone who's actually using it for work.
Right.
I used to use it just as a consumer, and it sucked up so much of my time. It made me feel like I wasn't doing enough. And so slowly, when I started to realize and recognize how that was impacting my mental health, I started to unfollow people that were making me feel that way. I would just kind of notice how my body was feeling or how my mind was feeling when I saw something that brought forth those feelings of not being enough. And as soon as I felt that way, I just unfollowed. It didn't matter if it was someone I'd known for a long time. I don't think that having someone on your friends list is going to impact your relationship with them in real life. And I think a lot of us are
very true.
Unsure of that. We think that that means something. And so I've just kind of filtered or made my feed a safer place for me, because I feel like we all have different needs when it comes to social media. And I've also opened up my world to, again, other people, other perspectives, but ones that make me think, not ones that make me feel bad. And so most of the time that I do spend on social media as a consumer now is just a small space for inspiration, a small space to make me laugh. I only limit like that to a really small time at the end of the day, because I'd rather prioritize other hobbies. And that's something I've learned, and it takes a lot of time to shift those habits. So it's not an easy one, but the small way to start shifting that is by unfollowing the people that don't make you feel good.
So basically curating your experience online.
Yes, 100%. I always went, I felt like I had to wear a new outfit every time I went out. So most of my consumer debt was spent on exactly that. I used to spend money to appease other people and to make other people's opinion of me shift into what I thought they wanted it to be. And I don't do that anymore. I spend my money on what makes me happy alone and things that help me grow, things that I genuinely want, not what other people want. And social media is such a fuel for people when it comes to those decisions, especially because they're so quick. You can easily spend money. I mean, I've done it. I've spent like $40 in 2 minutes. It takes no time at all if you see something you like. So it's a moment of reflection to pause, like, why am I buying this? Not, do I need this? Sometimes that question doesn't give us the answer we really need to make the decision that makes the most sense for our mental health.
So social pressures like that, as you said, can have a serious impact on mental health. Mental health and money are often positioned as an individual problem, but that kind of ignores so many of the other systemic issues at the heart of this. So what kind of money and mental health supports do you wish were available and more accessible to young Canadians?
It's such a big question. I wish that we had more empathy for providing people with their basic needs. I think that's something we overlook a lot, is that it starts from that. We need food, we need shelter, we need health care. Everyone needs those things. And people often scoff when I say, like, I would love if we had a universal basic income or UBI or programs like that to uplift people out of poverty. Because if we don't do something to tackle unaffordable housing, poverty, stagnant wages, inadequate healthcare, etc., like the list goes on, then we can't really create a system that benefits everyone equitably. And those are the places we have to look first, is what can we do to make sure that people can afford their basic needs.
And Alyssa, what's one big money tip or mental health tip that you'd like to share with our listeners today?
I think I would just tell people to reach out for help, whether that is professionally or personally, because I know that not all of us can handle that financially. We might not have the capacity to reach out to a mental health professional. But if you can find someone that you feel safe with to confide in, even if it's just a friend or a family member, that's super important, because suffering with something like financial instability is very hard to do alone. And no one should be as lonely as our society makes us feel like we should be. Like, money isn't something we often have small talk about, but it can be if you make it more normal and if you find those people that allow that conversation to be a place of safety rather than a place of shame.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's a really interesting take.
I just want to say thank you so much for your time today. That was great.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Next up, we're speaking with Chantel Chapman, a financial trauma researcher and co-founder of the Trauma of Money course. Her program brings together the psychology of trauma and scarcity and our relationship with money.
Chantel, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here with both of you today.
We're very excited to have you on the show. Chantel, can you tell us a bit about yourself to start off with?
About myself, yes. So I am tuning in from the traditional unceded territory of Musqueam, Kwantlen, and Tsawwassen's people, which is known as Richmond in British Columbia. I have worked in finance for now 19 years, and I started Trauma of Money about 3.5 years ago, but we've really been researching and developing the curriculum almost like unknowingly, probably for the last I don't know, I'd say my whole lifetime, actually, if I really look back at the root of the work.
It's a really interesting course. Can you tell us how you define financial trauma?
Yeah, so financial trauma is some language that we are seeing a lot now. Many finance experts are starting to talk about it. It's being shared a lot in the media. And the definition of financial trauma is when someone experiences something specifically around money. So this might be growing up in poverty, financial distress for, you know, let's say longer than 3 months, inability to retire, loss of a job, loss of assets, financial abuse within a domestic abuse relationship. So something specific happens with money and it results in trauma. So it basically impacts your sense of safety, your sense of worthiness, and it impacts the nervous system. So when you engage in money in the future, you may go into a state of kind of catapulting yourself into the past, into that time of the trauma, and that survival part of the brain, which shows up when we're in a trauma-activated state, will come into the situation with money.
And from some of the research, it does say that people who grow up in lower income groups can experience anxiety disorders, let's say twice the rate, just about 2.4 of people who grow up in adults in the highest income group. So I'm just wondering, how common do you find is the issue of financial trauma, and how does it typically manifest in young people, say people 18 to 34?
We actually have a slightly different view. You know, I always start off by defining financial trauma because this is kind of the buzzword right now in financial psychology is financial trauma. But at Trauma of Money, we have a little bit of a bigger view on what impacts the relationship with money. And we call that the trauma of money. We believe that any trauma that anyone experiences in their lifetime, or maybe it hasn't even been experienced in your lifetime, but your ancestors experienced it, it has the ability to impact the relationship with money, even if it has nothing to do with money. And what we've seen is that most people have experienced, or their ancestors have experienced, some sort of trauma. And because at its core, trauma impacts your sense of safety, your sense of security, and your sense of worthiness. And what does money represent in our society, or represent security and worthiness? So we've linked these two things, any type of trauma, potential to impact the relationship with money. And oftentimes, if trauma has been present around security, scarcity, or worthiness, it can show up with money, and that can result to anxiety and depression associated with money. And it's extremely, extremely common. I've actually seen from one of the financial psychologists who's one of my colleagues, Dr. Brad and Ted Klons, they talk a lot about compulsive spending. And they found that in their data that compulsive spending is just as common as anxiety and depression in the United States. And when I heard this research, I was like, it makes a lot of sense, because oftentimes the things that we do with our money that are unhelpful are ways to soothe the anxiety and depression. So I may have anxiety and depression because of trauma that might not have anything to do with money, but my soothing mechanism for my anxiety and depression might be shopping or financial avoidance. And then what happens is that leads to even more anxiety or depression. And then that's how it all becomes linked together.
Okay, interesting. And also a common reaction to trauma, you know, once getting over the initial shock, is usually denial. So you did mention people trying to perhaps hide money troubles, sweep them under the rug. I guess I'm wondering, in your own experience, how often does that behavior play out, and how does it play out specifically?
One of the biggest things that we see in our work is financial avoidance. And financial avoidance can essentially be a form of financial denial or financial rejection. And sometimes this happens with an awareness, but sometimes it's happening even subconsciously. So rejecting money in the way of, you know, under-earning, under-charging, and not really having a lot of awareness why we do it, but it is associated with this denial, this rejection, and this avoidance. The financial avoidance that's quite common that we see is just not looking at statements, not having an awareness of how much you spend every month or even how much income you bring in every month, not filing taxes, not having awareness of your credit score, not having conversations around money. And that might even be with your employer to ask for a raise. So these are some examples of financial denial or avoidance that we see. And when we compare it to states of the nervous system, we've all heard of fight, flight, or freeze. There's another one that we talk about, which is called fawning, which is essentially people-pleasing as a trauma response. But oftentimes this avoidance, it can fall into that freeze state. And at its like worst, it's a collapse. It's like I feel my nervous system feels so collapsed that I just don't have the ability to do these things. It can also fall into fawning. You know, I'm not going to have the conversation around money with my employer or my partner as a trauma response because I need to people please them as a response. If they're okay with me and I'm overgiving, then I'm safe in this relationship.
Very interesting. I know there was also a survey that we've looked at where there's 16% of Canadians did admit as of 2020 to hiding financial secrets from their partners. I guess I'm wondering if you come across that, and when you have, if basically that feeling of shame or wanting to please was a part of that.
So this is a bit of a tricky one. I sit on the National Task Force for Economic Justice, and what we do within that task force is we work with survivors of domestic abuse and financial abuse. And one thing that is crucial for these survivors is to hide an account, to hide certain aspects of their money in order to survive. They have to do that to create that pathway for them to get out of that relationship. However, there are other relationships where we call it financial infidelity is at play, where they're hiding aspects of their financial situation in a relationship where both parties agree that they're going to be sharing certain aspects. And when I was a mortgage broker, I actually saw this come up a lot where, you know, there would be partners there and they would be ready to buy a home together. And every time we go pull the credit bureau and the two of them are sitting there, you could feel the anxiousness. Like, is there something on there that I haven't disclosed to my spouse? And so, yeah, we do see it a lot. And is it linked to shame? Absolutely, it's linked to shame. There are certain gender-based narratives that folks have learned in society about how they should interact with money. Male-identifying folks have been told that your worth is associated with how much money you earn and, you know, and being good with money. And so if that's not present, there may be shame there and it may result in the partner to hide. And then on the other side, women-identifying folks have been told through mostly some of the systems that have existed around finances that they're not good enough with money. You know, it was up until what, 1970s, that a woman had to get a male cosigner for a credit card, right? So some of these narratives and these experiences show up today within certain gender identities. And so, of course, this can lead to shame. And one of the questions that we ask in Trauma of Money, it's one of our trademark questions, is whose shame is this? Because oftentimes the shame that we may carry around money actually doesn't even belong to us. It might come from a societal narrative. And so part of that process of like depersonalizing the shame is very helpful for us to move forward and change the patterns that we're looking to change.
Stress and money, money and stress. What comes first? It's that age-old question of the chicken and the egg. Are we bad with money because we are stressed or anxious or we've had trauma? Or are we stressed, anxious, and have trauma because we are bad with money? Or is it just an endless cycle both ways?
The answer is, from what I see, it's both ways. So, you know, there are folks that have a chronic stress, have experienced trauma. So anything that represents security and worth, they may have a hard time interacting with it. So therefore, the trauma and the stress impacts the relationship with money. And then on the flip side, there is money and interactions with money that can result in trauma. This is why we have terms like financial trauma, because certain experience specifically around money can result in chronic stress and eventually trauma. So it is really both. And you know, you mentioned the word cycle, they feed each other. They absolutely feed each other. Because the thing is money can cause a lot of stress, but we can also use money to basically soothe pain and increase our dopamine levels. So it's both, right? So we can feel stress about money, and then we'll go and buy something that we can't afford, and our dopamine increases. And then after, when the dopamine baseline needs to drop down to go into homeostasis, we'll go back into the state of being like, oh, I feel stress again. And then the nervous system's like, your dopamine's really low. You need to get that up higher. And especially the society that we live in tells us, if you ever feel pain, sad, lonely, bored, inadequate, something's wrong with you and you need to fix it right away. So we don't have a lot of experience maybe sitting with just like uncomfortable feelings because of some of the messages that we receive from consumerism. So it puts us on what psychologists call the hedonic treadmill.
So that ties into what you were saying a little bit earlier about kind of compulsive spending and the cycle around sort of financial denial and financial avoidance. I'm going to throw another stat your way. So Canadians 35 years of age and younger have the least amount of consumer debt, but are the worst at paying off their credit card balances, according to an Equifax study. Those aged 18 to 25 had a delinquency rate of 32% year over year in the third quarter of last year. So I find that really interesting because the trauma or the challenge perhaps isn't there. They have the least amount of debt and yet they're the worst at paying it off. But I imagine that could lead to some issues around, you know, if you're carrying debt through your young adult life, that just causes this endless cycle again of trauma. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting stat. And I mean, I'm just going to share some of my intuitive thoughts about that stat, because that's really all I have on that. And just some of the things that we see within our community. It feels to me like it may be because of affordability issues and inflation, and things are much more expensive now. And people seem to be in a position of under-earning, which under-earning essentially leads to overspending. And not overspending because maybe they're, you know, living large, but maybe they're overspending just to be able to survive.
And very quickly, Chantal, I mean, we haven't actually talked about the current state of the economy, but you did bring it up. And do you feel that there will be, you know, more people entering a state of financial trauma, or having, you know, are you just seeing more people with money stress and other kind of anxiety around their financial situations as a result of this economy that we're in?
Yeah, absolutely. I think coming out of the last few years with the pandemic, I think a lot of people's stability was really shaken. Their foundation was really shaken. And I think we're going to really start to see the impacts of that on a mental health level and on a financial level in the years to come, especially with what's happening with inflation right now. I also believe that we're going to just see more awareness around financial trauma and people now having language to describe some of the experiences that they're having, which is going to mean that we're going to hear about more people expressing some of these experiences, which at one side of it is painful that we're going to encounter so many folks who are expressing how much stress and trauma they are in around money. And then on the other side, it's hopeful, because once we can move away from that denial or that avoidance, we can actually move into a place where we can find interventions to support folks in these painful times around money.
There was another term that you brought up via your work, said financial codependency. I guess I was wondering if you're able to describe that for us, as well as look at basically how often do you see that pop up, and are kind of what are the most common causes or risk factors that you see that lead to financial codependency?
We see it so much because We work mostly with women and other identities that have been marginalized, and it seems to be one of the go-to trauma responses for folks who have historically been marginalized. And what financial codependency is when we essentially go to the fawning trauma response when we feel activated. So we lean into people-pleasing, and it's when we prioritize other people's comforts over our own. And it's also when we are so uncomfortable with other people's discomfort that we have this overdeveloped sense of responsibility to make things right. And the reason why we have done this is because historically in the past, maybe this is something that we experienced in childhood, where we grew up in an environment where we had to become very responsible at a young age because the environment was unsafe or chaotic. We learned somewhere along the way that if I am very responsible and I kind of take ownership for other people's discomforts and prioritize it over my own, that's where I will be safe. And this can manifest in multiple ways around money. It can show up in undercharging, under-earning, not having conversations with employers or clients or customers about money, not having conversations in relationship about money. This can result in overspending by the way of using your money like a please love and accept me fund. So you're the one who always gets the bill at lunch. You know, you're always kind of using your money to show your worthiness or to show your love. This can also show up in workaholism. So, you know, maybe you are working long hours to the point that you go into like cycles of like workaholism, burnout. And this could be not because you're obsessed with money and you're finding value from your work, but you might be actually people-pleasing the authority figures in the work environment. This can show up in the way as, you know, extreme risk-taking. So someone says to you, hey, you know, do you want to put some money in this deal I've got? And you can't say no to them because you're in that people-pleasing trauma response. And then the result is you've put yourself in financial risk. So these are some of the ways that this can show up. And like I said, it's extremely common. It is something that many folks that we work with relate to it.
Oh, interesting. And because I know you've mentioned in terms of the undercharging, overspending before, and I guess that basically all those kind of things kind of overlap depending on whatever reason people come to you. You kind of seem like those are pretty common markers of people coming from financial trauma in some way.
Yeah, that's right. So I would say the most common things that we see that cause quite a bit of distress would be financial avoidance, financial codependency, and then that can be the umbrella for financial avoidance, under-earning, overspending. And then also another thing that we see often too is underspending and excessive risk aversion. And so this is where, you know, some of us may think like you only have money stress if you overspend. But there are folks who experience chronic stress because of their underspending. So these are people who might have quite a bit of money in the bank account, but they are so impacted by scarcity mindset. Maybe they experienced scarcity in their childhood or their ancestors did, and they were raised with a scarcity lens that they have so much anxiety anytime they go and spend their money. And so, you know, just the simple act of buying a coffee is someone having in this situation, their nervous system might be so activated, or, you know, maybe even they're afraid to put money in a bank account or they won't open an investment. And that's all guided by fear. So this is another area or a financial disruption, a money disruption that we see that does impact people significantly.
If our listeners today have, you know, heard this conversation and think, okay, now, yeah, I think I have some form of financial trauma or I'm stressed about this or that, where can they go for that help? Do you find that, you know, financial advisors are talking about that today, or is it, you know, more like reading about it through blogs and, as you said, kind of financial literacy websites and things like that? What would your advice be for our listeners?
Well, one thing I'm so excited about is it's becoming a hot topic right now, this healing the relationship with money, financial trauma. So on many platforms, you can most likely interact with some content. I know we've got tons of Trauma of Money certified alumni who are on TikTok making incredible videos. And something that's really amazing is two of my colleagues, Dr. Brad and Ted Klons, they are financial psychologists in the US, and they're working with the CFP designation because CFP has now made it mandatory to have a financial psychology module in their training. And so this is incredible that we're starting to see financial professionals have this awareness. And then in our organization, we're starting to work more with financial professionals as well to bring this new level of awareness. So our whole dream and vision is that all financial professionals will be equipped with trauma sensitivity tools, and they can add that into their offering. And to access this yourself now, if you don't know a financial professional like that, even our website, Trauma of Money, we have a directory of professionals who have gone through our certifications. So you can find a Trauma of Money certified accountant or a CFP, but there's many spaces where you can access community of healing. For example, even Debtors Anonymous, or there's Under Earners Anonymous, or there's meetings for, you know, your worth. And there's so many resources out there. And you know, in the work that we do, we get to interact because we're a professional certification program. We get to interact with all these amazing professionals that are really integrating this lens into their offering, whether they're life coaches, business coaches, trauma therapists, accountants, mortgage brokers, CFPs.
That's great. Well, it certainly sounds like there's a lot out there for people. So thank you for raising awareness with our audience today. Thank you for joining us on Half Banked.
Thanks for having me.
And that was Half Banked. If you like this episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this podcast.
Special thanks to executive producer Samantha Eamon and producers Kevin Hamilton, Jenny Potter, Shane Murphy, James Bassin, Mary Alkaber, and technical producer Mohammed Tabish. This episode was edited by Lead Podcasting.